Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Well, Snooker Player Bingo was such a success the first time we did it that we've done it again. Phil Yates features again, inevitably, because he has more stories than anyone about the players. And we're joined as well by Mark Johnston Allen, former player now, Master of Ceremonies at various tournaments. If you didn't hear the first edition of this, it's a very simple concept. I've written out a list of 20 snooker players. They've all got a number from 1 to 20. Phil and Mark each pick a number, and then whatever number corresponds to the player, we have stories about those players. And again, we had a lot of fun doing it, so I hope you enjoy it. Mark, you can go first. Pick a number between 1 and 20.
17.
Number 17 is Marco Fu.
Okay, well, I'll start on Marco Fu because Mark's just gone really silent. Marco Fu, I think, would definitely get my vote to be the nicest guy on the circuit. Yeah. I've never known him complain. No. Or moan or have any gripes about anybody or anything. Even when he's lost a particularly heartbreaking match, he just seems to take it in his stride. Remember at the Welsh Open once, he fought back against Alan McManus from 4-1 down to 4 each. Potted, it was either the black or a re-spotted black to win 5-4 and went in off. And I was in the car with him, the courtesy car, on the way back to the hotel afterwards, and I expected him to be very silent, and he was perfectly civil, as though, you know, it was just any other day. I think he's got that wonderful temperament on and off the table.
Yeah,
he came down the Championship League one year, but it was because in the winter and it snowed. And well, there's two things about that. One, everyone was miserable about the snow, apart from his wife Shirley, who'd never seen it before from Hong Kong. She was loving it outside, taking pictures. But then at the end of the night, they weren't quite so thrilled with it because most people probably have not been to Cronin Park listening, but it's a long, long drive to get in, really long. And they got stuck halfway up. They had to be dug out. No, Marco's a lovely chap. And it may be that that's why he's not won, you know, as much as you could have done. Maybe he's too nice, you could argue.
He probably is the nicest man in snooker, isn't he? Yeah. If there was a league table, he'd definitely top it. I can't think of anything to say about him. He's just so nice, isn't he?
Yeah.
You are right. I've never seen him angry, upset.
His match of the World Championship this year against Barry Hawkins just had everything for me. It was one of the best matches I've ever commentated on. It was a good standard, really good fight back, great drama in the end, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. Of course, he was involved in one of the most extraordinary incidents in snooker when he won the IBSF World Amateur Championship in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. There was one day there in the group phase, where it was completely abandoned because they had an infestation of flying insects all over the tables and they couldn't play.
You need to get out more. Do you think, though, joking apart, because I really rate him.
Yes.
I think he's a fantastic player, but I think he's underachieved.
Yeah,
would you agree or not?
I think you can only measure a player by titles, can't you? Yeah. Now, he's won two ranking events, which, you know, a lot of players never won one, but it's a compliment to him to say that, because he is, I mean, he's still a top 16 player now, but maybe, I don't know, sometimes he seems to me gets a bit tired during tournaments, and maybe that's why he hasn't sort of lasted to the end of that many.
He burst on the scene, didn't he? Was it the Grand Prix?
No, he got
runner-up.
But
that was his first tournament.
Was that in Preston?
Yeah, it was his first tournament.
And I remember watching him. And I'm thinking, he didn't look like he's going to miss.
Mm. Yes.
And he was going to be the next big thing, wasn't he?
Yes.
That was the one that we were all talking about.
Yes.
Like Ding is now.
Yes.
Michael, and it didn't, for whatever reason, I don't know whether things off the table didn't work out for him or for whatever, but I don't think that ultimately, and I say it to his face if he was here, I don't think he fulfilled all of his potential.
Yes. I don't think he had the best time with the management company he was with, but we'll maybe move on from that to another number, Phil.
Okay, I'll go for number 19.
Well, one of the post-war world champions, John Pulman, of course, a commentator as well.
Yeah, absolutely. John Pulman had got a wonderful voice for commentary. His commentary style was very different to now. I mean, very different to the modern style. He wouldn't know a statistic if it hit him in the face. But he got a lovely turn of phrase, and obviously he knew the game inside out. And he was very witty also. But I think it was actually the voice itself, which was so melodic and deep. And I rated him as a commentator, actually.
What year did he stop commentating?
Well, it would have been when ITV stopped doing it, early 90s.
Yeah.
Because I got a feeling that I have commentated with him.
Really?
Yeah. No, I'm fairly sure whether it was ITV or Channel 4. Was it the Liverpool Victoria or something that they did in Derby? I'm fairly sure I've sat in a box with him.
Okay. Right.
And you are right, but his voice, that's all it needed, wasn't it? And I think it gets a bit lost nowadays, isn't it? We sort of just talk for talk's sake sometimes, and sometimes the way you present it or convey it is far more than the words that just keep on dribbling out. But yeah, he had it, didn't he?
Well, the most famous line, which was absolutely brilliant, They're at the Yamaha Organs Tournament, and the prize for the highest break was a Yamaha organ.
I love how you remember the
And I don't know what the high break prize was. It was, like, say, it was a 137, and somebody's on a 115 with a brown on the table. And his co-commentator said, well, you know, whoever it was could equal the high break here with a 137. And then, of course, John left it for a few seconds and then went, what do you do with half an organ?
Laconic, I think the word is.
Yeah.
Mark, pick a number.
Seven.
Number. This man is only on this for one reason. Tony Jones.
Unbelievable.
Of course, for those who don't know, beat Mark in the European Open final.
Yeah, he did. What year was it, Dave? Because I've got
91?
No recollection of stats at all. And it was
91?
It was in Rotterdam, I remember that. And we were both in the final. We were both outsiders. We shouldn't have been there, to be totally
honest. But you thought you were going to win, didn't you?
But I was very, very... I'd knocked out Stephen along the way, and then after that, I'll be honest with you, the draw.
Stephen who, sorry?
Stephen Hendry. Very good, Phil.
Yeah.
And I think, and then, I don't think it was that difficult, to be honest with you, not being disrespectful, but I think I had Dino Kane and Cliff Thorburn when he wasn't at his best. Somebody else, I can't remember. But I get to the final, I think, I can't lose this one. And it wasn't any disrespect to Tony, it was just I felt that I'm finally waking up after a few bad years. And I think I was 5-2, 5-3 up, I think. And then I think we all went out for lunch and I didn't drink or anything like that, but just very relaxed and didn't really have a practice and came back. In all fairness, the night session, for the standard of snooker that was, he played really well.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's pulled me back and I thought, oh no, it's too late. Your mindset is all completely wrong. And I think that would have been my little stepping board. You know, that was the ticket to the Masters. That was you've got a title under your belt. You can do it. And I didn't treat him with enough respect. I looked at him and thought he was quite an ungainly player, wasn't he? He didn't look good.
Mm.
You know. So I watched him. I thought, no, you're good. But then all of a sudden, he didn't miss. And it was a lesson, really, that you know you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, should you? Mm. But
you got to the final of the European Open the following year in Tonga and in Belgium.
That's it.
But you played Jimmy White there, of course, which is a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, but I've got mitigating circumstances for that one because that was an all right run, in all fairness. I've beaten Hendry again, beat Parrott along the way. I was playing some decent snooker. And beat Mick Price, my nemesis, could never beat Mick. And then in the final, my friends had... In those days, you could only watch it via CFAX. So the scores...
Probably for some of the best. We saw the matches.
Black and white and CFAX. So they'd seen that I'd been Parrott on the Friday night or Saturday night, whatever night it was. And they jumped in that little Fiat Uno. May had a little Fiat Uno. Five of them. Windscreen wipers weren't working. Got on a ferry, drove down to Tongeren. I woke up in the morning, Sunday morning. Dad said, look who's in the next room. And the five of them were there. And I thought, well, that's just amazing. You know, what a lovely bunch of blokes. But little did I know that... At the start, I've told Dave this story before. At the start of the event, the announcer, the MC, blah, 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 you know, Von Mark, Johnson Allen, they're all cheering like that. And then Jimmy's, But come the evening session, because I was 6-2 down after the first session, they'd all gone out on the lash on this Duval beer. Come the evening session, Von Mark, Johnson Allen, boo, go on, Jimmy. And that was it then, never to reach a final again. But Tony Jones, underrated player.
Tony Jones, well, the extraordinary story about him, that I'm sure it's true, because I know the person who was involved in this, because he lived in Chesterfield, which is near Sheffield. So Tony Jones is playing at the Crucible, possibly for the first time, but certainly he'd be around that time where he beat you. And so they've gone to pick him up. He's on in the morning with 10:30 or whatever. So they've turned up about 9:00, pick him up, he's still in bed. And so they've called up, Tony, what do you want? You know you're playing, you know, in an hour. Where? At the Crucible. In the World Championship. He just forgot he was in the World Championship.
Yeah, true.
He was very quiet. I mean, I don't know... You know, I don't know what went on with his life off the table, you know, but he was very... But he was always really polite to me, and he's always... You know, he just kept himself to himself. I don't know, you know. But, respect for him.
Yeah.
To win a ranking event, respect, isn't it?
And in that era, you know, to make his way into the top 16, which he did...
Yeah.
You know, to do that, you've got to be able to play.
He was a far better player than people realised, yeah.
Okay, Phil.
Okay, I will go for number two.
Well... A colleague of yours at ITV. He was going to be on. Well, he was on the last podcast, but only because he stumbled into it. Alan McManus.
Right. Okay. Well, Alan McManus, what an absolute legend.
Mm. Yeah.
When you commentate with Alan, you realise what you already knew deep down, that his depth of knowledge of the game is second to none. I mean, the analytical brain that man has got is extraordinary, isn't it, really? He knows every nuance, every shot, and nicknamed Angles for an obvious reason. His geometrical appreciation of a snooker table.
It's incredible. Incredible. He even knew the date last week, or the year last week, this week, when they're talking about the steel block tables, when they were swapped from BC to Riley. I can remember that. I knew we changed them. I mean, I got memory like a sieve. We sat down at the English Open last week. We sat down for half an hour, 40 minutes, and he was reeling off matches we played as amateurs, where we were in Ponty.
Yes.
I couldn't remember any of it. He knew the names I played, the people he played. It was absolutely fascinating. And it was fascinating.
Yeah.
And his idea of where snooker's going was really interesting as well, because he was talking to me about the kids that they don't practice anymore. They're all on their iPads, their Xboxes, which is why he believes he's still maintaining this level now, because no youngsters are coming through. And when I listened to him, I thought, you're absolutely spot on. The amateur game's not there.
Mm.
You know, but he's so passionate about all of it, isn't he? I felt embarrassed. I had nothing to give him back. I just sat there and listened.
Yeah.
You're right about the passion. The one thing I loved about Al McManus more than anything else, and I love lots about him, there was a question he was asked about, what was his greatest win? And you know what he said? I thought it was the Masters or one of those two ranking events he won. No, the greatest win in his mind was the pro ticket match he won to become professional. That opened the doors. That made my life.
I get it, because they were huge events. I don't think people would remember them, but you go to some events and ultimately there'd be 400, 500, 600 people trying to go for one of those 8 spots, and it was terrifying. You know, and you had to be in the top 8 to qualify. That was in that proper system for me. You actually earned that ticket, and you, not the time when you all paid your £1,000, your nan can turn up and bash a few balls around the table. But what he says there is spot on. It's often taken for granted, actually.
You won the 2 ranking titles and the Masters, plus a couple of other tournaments. But he was such a regular in semi-finals and finals in his heyday. It was frightening. One of the most consistent players you're ever likely to see.
And I love the fact that when we were chatting last week, he said that he still loves practising. And that says it all, doesn't it?
Well, he's one of these. He's shown the game proper respect, and he's got the rewards because of that. And we saw him, obviously, at the Crucible. I mean, incredible this year, getting to the semis and just playing so well, and clearly loving every minute of it. And let's hope he continues for some time. He's one of the game's sort of proper pros for me. And he's become like a senior player now, hasn't he? Like, you can see young players look up to him, which is great.
Well, other veterans, who we won't mention any names, were moaning like billio about the qualification system for the World Championship this year. You know, if you're basically at the side of the 16, you've got to play 3 qualifying matches and then almost immediately go to the Crucible. And what people were saying was, at a certain age, you know, if you're in the 40s, you've got no chance through stamina. And Alan completely disproved that theory. Got through the 3
absolutely
qualifying matches and then got to the semi-finals. Fantastic.
If anything, it's better though, isn't it? Surely.
Yeah, yeah.
We've always had to play 3 qualifying matches, and if you're hot and you've just won the 3, you want to carry straight on, don't you? You're not a month off.
Well, I think it helped Ding. The 3 matches gave him confidence back. And
yeah, well, you know, you've got moaners. And
yeah. Well, so there might be someone on this list. Yeah. Who knows?
Fingers crossed.
Mark, your turn to pick.
I'll go for 11, please, Dave.
11 is Alison Fisher, former women's world champion. Went to play pool in America, of course.
Now, my only recollection of Alison Fisher is in Pontins. I mean, I knew Alison well. She had a fantastic cue action. She was almost like, at one stage, the female version of Steve Davis. It was perfect. I think, was she coached by Frank Callan as well?
She was definitely.
Technically, she was absolutely brilliant. But she, in Pontins in the old days, you played upstairs, there's 20-odd tables, and the Pontins tournament was a big event. You win that, and people always took notice of you. And I remember she gave me a really good spanking on the table, that is.
Just to clarify.
On the snooker table.
Upstairs in front of a lot of people. I think she may have beat me 4-0. And obviously, in those days, you know, it wasn't as politically correct as it is nowadays. So, you know, rather than everybody saying, well done, Alison, they're all looking at me going, you just lost to a girl. But she played brilliantly, you know. And the pockets were really, really tight, and I probably didn't show enough respect, but she played better than me. She was a fantastic player.
Her highest break was 144.
Right.
She won the World Mixed Doubles Championship with Steve Davis on more than one occasion. I was in Hamburg to see her do it on Screen Sport. I was commentating, and she made the decisive break in the decider. Couldn't agree with you more. I personally think she was the best woman player ever.
Yes. Yeah.
She got to about 192, I think, best ever in the world rankings, because she couldn't deal with the qualifiers at Blackpool. the cubicles where you watch by one man and a dog if you're lucky. But when she was in front of the cameras, she was fantastic. And what she did, you might not know this in America, the full extent of it. When she went over there, obviously it was about a year of acclimatisation to a new environment and also to the game itself, because although nine ball pool, the pockets are bigger and all that kind of stuff, there's lots of little nuances to get used to. And once she got used to the game, she absolutely dominated the WPBA Tour, which is the Women's Professional Billiards Association Tour. And even this year, she won the WPBA Masters in her mid-40s. Can't speak highly enough of her.
She's still making a living from it out there?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you something. The biggest regret, I think, Snooker had in... Or one of the biggest regrets Snooker had in the 90s was not giving her a wild card to the Masters. It would have created massive interest.
Because she was good enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, she, the first person she beat in a professional event, we've got to say this, was our good mate Neil Foulds, who was so devastated by it that he went back to his house and turned his phone off for 2 days.
Well, she's of course the Duchess of Doom, that's what they call her.
Duchess of Doom?
Yeah. Well, it's a proper
she was a nice lady. Yeah.
Phil, is it your turn, Phil?
No,
it's Mark's turn.
I'll go for six.
Cliff Wilson.
The only recollection that I had of Cliff, I used to practice in a club in Fishbourne called Pot Black, and I was quite close to the Welsh players. Bristol's not far from South Wales, so I was going over there a lot with Tony Chappell, and it was Wayne Jones, was it, Mark Bennett? And Cliff was an older generation back then. I remember that they got Cliff over to an exhibition at Pot Black once, and he was a bit of a lad. Mm. He was the old school, wasn't he? The jokes were dirty, but he was funny. But you could tell that he plied his trade through the years of going around all the working men's clubs and doing his thing. I found him really, really fun. I was only 15. And then the next time I sort of crossed paths with him was at was in Newport once when the Welsh Open had finished, and I got a call to be on standby to do an exhibition, and it was with Cliff Wilson. And I was so young, I didn't know what I was doing. I was like a rabbit in headlights. But he held that audience for a good hour with his jokes and his trick shots, and I thought, what a funny man. Sadly missed.
Well, three stories about Cliff, all short. Wembley Conference Centre, he's playing in the Masters. At the interval, after four frames, doesn't go back to his dressing room, just walks up three or four steps and goes and sits with the Chelsea pensioners who were watching the game for the entire mid-session interval, and then came back into his chair. Classy move.
Yeah.
Classy move. That's one. The second was in a toilet at Prestatyn.
He said, slightly different story.
Yeah. So he's in there, you know, answering the call of nature, presumably, and this bloke comes in and he went, "You're all right, Cliff, you old has-been." And he went, "No, better to have been an has-been than an ever will be." And I thought, what a great line. Yeah. But there were a couple of swear words intermingled in that as well. Yeah. And the third thing was just how phenomenally talented.
Huge.
The advert in snooker scene for exhibitions involving Cliff was you've never seen anything like it. And at the time, they hadn't.
No.
He was from Tredegar originally, which is the same town as Ray Reardon, and they had a great rivalry. And then he stopped playing the game for many years. He was
15 years.
Yeah, he was a shop steward in a steelworks. Yeah, and then he came back and did all this wonderful stuff in his 50s.
He was brilliant.
Yeah.
Really, got really in the good. Top 16, didn't he? That's why he would have been at the Masters quite late on. Won the World Seniors Championship.
He did, beating Eddie Charlton in the final. Mm. Charlton, Mr. Brown, I remember.
That's a contrasting style, isn't it? Yeah.
But he gave me one of my best.
Are you sure it was the brown, not the blue?
Yeah, it was brown. Right. He gave me one of my best ever stories, Cliff Wilson. We were at the Preston Guildhall, and he's playing in the World Championship qualifiers. And it's a two-session match, and he'd been staying at the Holiday Inn just across the way, across the car park there. Anyway, he came back, and he got his suit and everything on, and went, "You're all right, Cliff?" He went, He got no false teeth in.
Really? I never knew.
Yeah, what had happened, basically, he'd ordered a room service sandwich in between sessions, eaten the sandwich, taken his teeth out, put it on the tray. The girl had come in, took the tray away with the teeth on. So he played the entire last session without his dentures.
Wow, I'm not quite sure how we follow that, but we'll try. Yeah. Phil.
Okay, I'll go for number 11.
We've had that.
Okay, number 12.
Graham Miles. Well, another character, Graham Miles. I mean, I'll start here. This is only a few years ago because he passed away quite recently, but maybe a year before that. We had a thing in the magazine Past Masters in snooker scene, and I rang him up because he ran Samwell Snooker Centre and just wanted to chat about his career. But he pretended not to be Graham Miles. He's like, "Oh, he's not here," and all this, you know. And then he said, "But ring him on this number." He gave me this mobile number. "Ring him on that, like, 6 o'clock," which I did. It wasn't his number. It was just some random. Yeah, just it, like, and this went on for a couple of days until eventually I rang her back and I said, "You know, is Graham there?" And he put on a voice. "I'll go and get him," and then come back and done the interview like that. So a bit of an eccentric.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Graham, I got the interview in the end, but
Graham was involved in one of the most extraordinary matches ever. He played Jim Meadowcroft in a tournament. I think it was in Ipswich. Anyway, regardless of where it was, they both turned up late, so it was two each at the interval, and neither of them had potted a ball.
No.
Yeah. But World Championship runner-up in 1974 to Ray Reardon.
Was he really?
Yeah, yeah. And he made his name by winning Pod Black, I think, twice.
Yeah, when it was like a big deal, because there were no tournaments really other than the World Championship, and even that wouldn't have been on live every day, so Pod Black was the thing to win.
I never had any dealings with him, so I can't give you anything, Dave.
Okay, that's not like you.
he was one of the most extreme left-hand sighters you've ever seen in your life.
I've never seen him play. Yeah.
I saw him play an exhibition match once at a place called Quarrybank Labour Club, which is quite close to me, in the West Midlands, and the table I knew wasn't particularly good because I played league matches on it myself, and he made a century, and after every two shots just turned around and told a joke and then got back to the break. It was just... Back then, the game to earn a living was totally different to what it is now.
Well, absolutely. You had to ply your trade, didn't you?
Exactly.
You had to go out and entertain, and, you know, that's the way you earn your money. And that's why they built up their personalities, didn't they? They could do that in a match and switch off that 30 seconds and get back. Nowadays, we haven't got that.
Towards the end of his career, he's playing at Blackpool at the Norborough Castle Hotel in one of the booths in a qualifying match against Andrew Cairns from Blackpool. And there's me, one of Graham's mates, who I also knew, Andrew Cairns, Graham, and the referee was Len Ganley. And anyway, it was at the time where there was a little bit of sort of controversy and confusion about the application of the misrule. The referee, Len, had called Graham for a couple of misses, and you could see this mate of Graham's not too happy about it. Anyway, Cairns was in this really, really tough snooker. He missed the reds, and you know, by a fraction, and didn't leave anything on. And he didn't call Andrew. So the ref's gone, foul. And this guy in the audience has stood and gone, and a miss.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Right, Mark.
13.
13 is Ray Edmonds, Grimsby legend, world amateur champion, commentator.
Yeah, no, I know Ray well. I could never work him out because there's almost two sides to Ray. You know, you've got to be careful what you say. On one side, when he was with other people, he could be a little bit condescending, I'd find, and yet when we were on our own on a one-on-one, he'd be very nice, and he's a very intelligent man, very knowledgeable. You know, I went through some really bad times. I can remember him saying to me, I said to him, it can't get any worse, Ray. He went, yeah, it can. and I thought, I looked at the rankers, I was down to six, and I thought, well, it's a long list, actually. He's right. And like on another occasion, I remember we all flew to Thailand when, you know, obviously what happened in Thailand, and it's, I get no pleasure out of it at all. But we had picked up from a coach at the airport, that everyone has picked up from a coach at the airport. And I had, you know, I had my missus with me, so, you know, I was clean. But he sat on the, I sat at the front with Shelley, and he's to the left. He looked at me and I said, what are you doing here? And I said, what are you doing here? I thought, you cheeky so-and-so, implying, you know. And
you haven't qualified,
yeah. Yeah, and then we'd go out in the night time, and he was very knowledgeable and very helpful, and you know, try this, try that.
Yeah.
So there was two sides to him.
He liked an argument. That's not a secret. Anyone in the snooker world, he enjoyed arguing and was very good at it. And would usually, whatever your position was on anything, he would take the opposite. He's one of those contrarian, really. Yeah. And he just enjoyed it, didn't he? And liked an argument.
Well, you know the Monty Python sketch where the guy goes in and pays money to have an argument for 15 minutes?
That's Ray, is it?
Ray could have made a nice few quid doing that. I mean, I got on great with him. I really liked him.
It was never nasty. It was never a nasty thing. He just enjoyed an argument.
Yeah. We got very different political views, and we used to have a few, you know, debates, let's put it that way. But I always enjoyed his company. Must be remembered, a former world amateur champion, you know, played at the Crucible, all that kind of stuff.
World Billiards champion.
Yeah, and he was also, I think he was also the first ever winner of the pool competition on that iconic ITV series, Indoor League.
Indoor League, yeah.
Which was hosted by Fred Truman, and he won the pool event on that, yeah.
Wow, and where is he now?
He lives in Spain, he's retired, yeah. And of course, he has his snooker. I think his son runs his snooker club in Grimsby, doesn't he?
That's right. And a very, very good commentator, I thought.
No, I thought he had a wonderful voice. And I don't. What happened with the?
I don't know. But it was a shame because he was a really good commentator.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Okay, we'll do two more. Phil, you go next.
Okay, I'll do number five.
Mick Price.
Right. Okay. Well, I used to write By the way, we're doing this podcast here at the Ricoh Arena in Coventry during the Champion of Champions, and I used to write for the Coventry Evening Telegraph on Mick Price's matches. So every time he played, I used to do 10 or 12 paragraphs for them. And obviously, if it was a bigger match, you know, we'd do more and more. And there were so many great stories of Mick. What a nice man he was.
Diamond.
You know, just tremendous. Two things I'll never forget about him. Obviously, he was the man in the seat when Ronnie O'Sullivan made the 147. Yeah. And the other thing was, we were in the Grand Prix once, and he was having an absolutely fantastic season. He'd done so well in qualifiers. We're at the Grand Prix, and I'm expecting him to win this match. I forget who he was playing. And it was mid-October, you know, autumn just about descended on the country. And it was a really, really damp, horrible day. And as he walked from the hotel to the arena, the Hexagon in Reading, there was a downpour. Water got into his cue case.
No.
And the tip of the cue got damp.
Oh.
And basically made it impossible to play, and he lost the match 5-0.
Oh,
yeah.
What a shock!
So
right. He was actually my nemesis. You know that with certain people that you can't lose to, and certain people that you can't not lose to. I couldn't beat him. I couldn't. And he played. It'd be fair to say he was here a couple of years ago. Great to see him. I haven't changed. Yeah. Looks exactly the same. And because we used to take the Mickey out, he used to look like Postman Pat, didn't he? That was the look we used to say. But he looked ungainly when he played, but what an incredible player. I think the only time I did beat him was when I got to the final in Tongeren. I beat him over there in Belgium. It was 5-4. It was an absolute howler. But he had it over on me. Really underrated player.
When he retired from playing, and for a brief time, he was in the press room doing his manager's website. And at the Crucible one year, he stood up at stage door, and this punter, you know, they sort of hang out there. They came up to him and they sort of studied him for a few seconds. And the guy said to him, "Excuse me, didn't you used to be Mick Price?" And Mick's kind of gone, "Well, I sort of still am." But actually, he said about the thing with Ronnie, he said it's great. He said, "I live on as the answer to a Trivial Pursuit question."
He was witty, wasn't he, as well?
He was very funny,
he was.
Self-deprecating, nice guy. Yeah. He once played an exhibition where there were sort of two tables next to each other, and they were all sort of round the one table, and he made a 147, you know, everybody sort of clapped. And then these four guys said, "Do you mind if we just have a doubles match?" And they played a doubles match on the other table while he was carrying on the exhibition.
My
Yeah.
Right, we'll do one more then, Mark.
18.
Ian McCulloch, Preston's finest. Semi-finalist in the World Championship. He was very unlucky, wasn't he? Because he got in the top 16 when Sean Murphy won the World Championship. And Sean, even though he won the World Championship, hadn't done enough to get in the top 16, but it was automatically seeded second, or ranked second for every event, which meant that Ian, well, as he put it, was world number 16 and a half. He had to qualify and so on, which was unlucky because he'd spent a lot of time to get in the top 16.
Yeah, and a very, very hard worker, both in terms of dedicated practice for tournaments and also to supplement his income. We've just talked about exhibitions with other players. He was the one who kept it on, really. And what he did was he said to clubs, "OK, I will want this fee, but if I don't make a century break during the evening, I won't get the fee at all." So it was a good deal for them. But the amount of times he didn't do it, you could count on one hand.
Seriously.
And of course, you're going around clubs where the tables are of variable quality, to put it diplomatically. So to do that, I thought, was both enterprising, and it just underlined his skill.
He did a few with Dennis. I think he learned from Dennis how to do all that, because obviously Dennis is like the ultimate kind of sort of showman in exhibitions. And I think Ian took that on board and realised that was another avenue rather than just tournament play. You could have that sort of string to your bow as well.
He didn't have much to do with it. He was a character, wasn't he? I think, you know, the times I've seen him, he wasn't shy, was he?
He beat Dotty at the Crucible, Graham Dott, and sort of danced off the stage, didn't he? And I think Graham was a little bit annoyed.
Yeah. Wish he would, didn't he?
Yeah.
But did he... What happened to him in the end? Because he was right out there, wasn't he?
He had shoulder problems, which prevented him from playing, basically.
He's no longer involved?
No. I think he might manage some players. Is he involved with Ian Burns?
Yeah, and I think he does, or he was doing a little bit, one of the bookmakers, sort of their radio service. It was a shame. Like one of these players who, you know, sort of reached the heights. I mean, he got to a couple of ranking finals.
Yes.
But then, as you say, it's quite a common thing: shoulder or back trouble starts, and then it's kind of, there's no way back, really.
And he appears in a Hollywood movie, Ian McCulloch.
You can't see Mark's face here.
I hate to know the name.
No.
He said Hollywood.
Yeah. Garfield 2. You know Garfield the cat?
This is
Garfield 2, A Tale of Two Kitties. And basically Garfield...
A Tale of Two what?
A Tale of Two Kitties.
Kitties, right.
So
I just want to get that.
Yeah. So Garfield basically comes over from America to to Britain, and he's in this stately home. I'm not going to give
you
the plot.
You are amazing.
No, the reason I know this.
Well, the reason is because you're in it.
I'm in it as well. Yeah.
That's the reason he's brought it up. Because he's in it.
So in order to, so Garfield's lying on this bed in this stately home, and obviously the producers had to sort of find something uniquely televisual to the UK, you know, just to show that he was in the United Kingdom watching TV. So the camera cuts to the TV, and there is Mark Williams playing Ian McCulloch. With me commentating?
No.
Yeah, got no royalties.
Oddly enough, they never made Garfield 3. I don't know why. No idea why.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark and Phil, and we'll be back. We'll do it again sometime.